explain these two types of ubudiyah. Of course, as we have said in all of our programs, ubudiyah translates into servitude. Now, this ubudiyah of for Allah, or this ubudiyah to Allah, meaning this servitude to Allah, this worship to Allah, this obedience to Allah, this ubudiyah to Allah, it can have different types and different faces, if you will. Now, one type of ubudiyah is formal ubudiyah. Now, when we are talking about formal ubudiyah, formal servitude, of course, this deals with the five daily prayers, the Salah, Fajr, Dhuhr, Asr, Maghrib, and Isha. These five daily prayers, of course, are formal ubudiyah. It is the ubudiyah and the servitude and the worship and the obedience that the Almighty Allah has specifically delineated for each and every single one of us at a certain age or at a certain point of maturity. It becomes obligatory and wajib upon us to do this formal ubudiyah. But now this formal ubudiyah is not limited to just the five daily prayers. It also includes the mustahab, the recommended prayers, or as is known, the nafila prayers, or the different other kinds of formal ubudiyah, the different kinds of actions, the recommended actions that one can do in every single month. Of course, the fasting in the holy month of Ramadan is a form of this formal ubudiyah. Going to the Hajj is a form of formal ubudiyah. And the recitation of the Quran and even the recitation of du'as, which are recommended, supplications, litanies, which are recommended, these are all forms of formal ubudiyah.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Manan,
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, Ya Manan, haqqiq amanina. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Hello everyone. Today's question asks, why do Muslims pray? One of the most important rulings in Islam is the daily prayer that Muslims must partake in. Maybe you have seen Muslims in large groups say prayer together on TV. You might think it looks a little weird because there is so much action involved in prayer. Why don't Muslims just clasp their hands together, become reverent, and speak their prayers silently? Why must there be a loud call to prayer and a set time for these prayers to be said in? This is because Muslims all around the world pray the same prayer, in the same way, and at the same times. In total, there are five separate prayers that Muslims recite in Arabic. This is so that there can be conformity for all prayers said. But the true beauty of the prayer lies in the meaning, and so many Muslims choose to look up the translation of the prayer in their own language, so that they truly know what they are reciting. The reason for the actual prayer is so that Muslims always focus on being kind and doing the right thing, no matter the circumstances. In Islam, it is believed that the world is a testing ground for humans, in which they have to always choose for the right over the wrong. It is also believed that humans, after they die and on Judgment Day, will be judged based on their actions on earth. The prayer, therefore, acts as a sort of shield against wrongdoings that might tempt the people. They help remind people that their life on earth is short and serve as a means to put life in perspective. Think of it this way. Let's say you are sitting in an exam at school. Initially, you know that this is an exam and that you have to do your best in order to pass with a good grade. Throughout the exam, however, you also have the teacher supervising you and also a clock to tell you how much more time you have left. The teacher and the clock both reinforce the fact in your mind that you are taking an exam so that you do not slack off, dawdle, or cheat. The Muslim daily prayers serve the same purpose. They allow you to connect with God on several occasions throughout the day. They also help you remember that you are on earth for a short period of time and that you are responsible for your actions at all times. Now imagine during your exam, your teacher would not be there to supervise and there would be no means to tell the time during your exam. Would you still be trying as hard to finish your exam well? Or would you start talking with your classmates, cheat, or even take out your sandwich and indulge because you think you have the time to do so? Without daily prayers, Muslims would have a much harder time focusing on their actual purpose in life. They would not strive to be the best version of themselves that they could be and would indulge in the non-essential things in life. So why not try praying once in a while? Try taking a minute or two, a couple times a day, just to focus on a connection with the Creator.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation, we were talking about the difference between formal ubudiyya and informal ubudiyya. And so in the previous segment, we were talking about formal ubudiyya. We talked about the different types of formal ubudiyya that we can do in our daily lives. And of course, we said how this formal ubudiyya breaks down into wajib, obligatory forms of worship, and of course, mustahab, recommended forms of worship. Of course, this formal ubudiyya in and of itself has its own status, it has its own importance, and of course, they are so valuable for our spiritual growth and progression and ubudiyya that the Almighty Allah has in some cases made them obligatory and wajib, and in some other cases, He has made them mustahab and recommended. But in this segment, we want to talk about informal ubudiyya. So now that we know what formal ubudiyya is, of course, you might wonder what is informal ubudiyya. So informal ubudiyya, or informal servitude to Allah, worship to Allah, and obedience to Allah, is this kind of servitude that a person does to Allah and for Allah, which is outside the bounds of this formal wajib and mustahab type of things. In a very loose form, we can say that informal ubudiyya can be part of a mustahab ubudiyya in a very general sense. But when we talk about mustahab prayers, you know, we are talking about a relatively formal type of ubudiyya, such as the nafila prayers. These are very formal, recommended type things. But the informal ubudiyya, such as giving charity in the name of Allah, or such as doing our best to remember Allah in our daily lives, or to remember to thank Allah as much as we can, or to remember to ask for forgiveness from Allah, or perhaps to do a good deed in our lives for the sake of Allah, or in order to read a book about religion, or read a book about something that is good spiritually and is good for our religion. All of these things become an informal type of servitude to Allah. Now, of course, the precedence and the priority is with the formal ubudiyah, but in the time that we have on our hands, the extra time, you could say, why not gain this extra level of ubudiyah, which is this informal ubudiyah, this conversation with Allah, this doing of small actions for the sake of Allah, and of course this informal ubudiyah has value and importance in it of itself as well.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parstoday.com.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
When we look at ahadith, we find again tawakkul is one of the most important characteristics that were given to the Prophet. This is a very beautiful hadith. For those who have the book Sunan al-Nabi, in Sunan al-Nabi, when it one of the chapters describes the characteristics of the Prophet. So Sunan al-Nabi describes the Prophet very beautifully, one of the best books which describes the Prophet. So it describes the characteristics of the Prophet. And the chapter that describes the characteristics of the Prophet, I forget the hadith number, but I think it's something around 36 or so. It has a very lengthy hadith in which Jibreel alayhi salam comes down to Prophet Muhammad and he says that I have come bearing gifts for you, O Prophet of God. So he says, what are these gifts that you have come bearing for me? He says, the first gift that we have for you is patience. But then he said, we have something better than patience. So the Prophet says, what is better than patience? He says, I'm bringing you the gift of rida, satisfaction. But Allah has given you something greater than satisfaction. So the Prophet says, what can be greater than satisfaction? So he says, az-zuhud, asceticism, and something better than asceticism. So the Prophet says, what can be better than zuhud? He says that Allah has sent you ikhlas, sincerity. And then the Prophet says, what can be better than ikhlas? He says, he sent you yaqeen, certainty in him. He says, but he has sent you something better than yaqeen. And the Prophet says, what can be better than yaqeen? He says, he has sent you tawakkul. He has sent you the trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to be able to rely upon God. Now the reason for mentioning Sunan al-Nabi is the Prophet then asks the angel to describe each one of these things for him. He says, describe to me tawakkul, describe for me zuhud, describe for me yaqeen. And in that book, there's this very lengthy hadith, but Angel Jibreel describes each one of these characteristics in a very beautiful manner. I'm only going to touch upon tawakkul. So after the Prophet, after Jibreel alayhi salam says to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, that Allah has given you tawakkul. And this is where it ends. He doesn't say after tawakkul there is something better than tawakkul. So in the end result, tawakkul is that top gift that he had been given. So the Prophet says to him, okay, what is tawakkul? So the angel describes, he says, al-ilmu bi-anna al-makhluqa la yadurru wa la yanfa'u wa la yu'ti wa la yamna'u. He says, tawakkul is the knowledge that the creation of God cannot harm you, nor can they benefit you. Okay, this is very beautiful hadith. Okay, if you can stay with me, it would be great. He says, بِأَنَّ الْمَخْلُوقُ لَا يَضُرُّ وَلَا يَنْفَعُ. He says, it is the knowledge that the creation of God cannot benefit you, nor can they harm you. وَلَا يُعْطِي وَلَا يَمْنَعَ. Nor can they deny you anything, nor can they provide you anything. It is the knowledge that the creation of God cannot harm you or benefit you or deny you or give you anything. وَالْإِسْتِعْمَالُ الْيَأْسِ مِنْ خَلْقٍ. And it is to have complete despair in the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That they cannot do anything to you, and in fact almost to the extent where you don't need anything from them. So this is how he describes tawakkul, but it continues. فَإِذَا كَانَ الْعَبْدُ كَذَلِكَ. He says, if a servant of God can think in this manner, that the creation of God cannot harm me or benefit me, and I don't need anything from them, لِأَحَدٍ سِوَى اللَّهِ. If he can think of this and believe this, about everyone except for God. وَلَمْ يَرْجُوا وَلَمْ يَخَفْ سِوَ اللَّهِ And does not hope in nor does he fear in anyone except for God. وَلَمْ يَطْمَعْ فِي أَحَدٍ سِوَ اللَّهِ And is not satisfied with anyone except for Allah. This is tawakkul, he says to him. فَهَذَا tawakkul.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. جل في علا هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحما حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روبا شابت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
British Premier League football team Tottenham Hotspurs have come under fire ahead of a pre-season friendly match. The fixture, pitting Tottenham against Italian side AS Roma, scheduled in Haifa on July the 30th, has been condemned as an attempt to normalise crimes against Palestinians by critics.
The fans, especially amongst whom are many people of Muslim background or of ethnic minorities, they will be big supporters of the Palestinians, but the team going out there is a slap in the face for them.
The London-based Human Rights Commission launched a letter campaign encouraging supporters to write to Tottenham and demand the club cancel the controversial fixture. Elsewhere, pro-Palestine supporters condemned the fixture online.
We have an epidemic of Russophobia in this country and across the whole of the West, but there is no similar attempt to hold Israel to account for its crimes. 74 years since Israel was created, out of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, people who are still refugees with no home to go to.
Israel has been recognised by Amnesty International as an apartheid regime. Their crimes have been well documented for many years. Just days prior to Tottenham announcing the fixture, international outrage was sparked over the slaying of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhileh.
Tottenham have so far not commented on any of the criticism, but they did announce last May that they were delighted with their planned tour of Israel. This suggests that perhaps Tottenham Hotspurs is not as concerned about human rights abuses as perhaps they should be. Robert Carter, London.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for ihram, located at different directional quarters from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear ihram and make niyat, the intention of performing hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy. Just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic, a combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civili, Rome.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After three decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies. When Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the eight-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belong to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
It was the announcement years in the making. An opportunity for Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon to lay out her party's vision for a Scotland free of Westminster control.
Presiding officer, now is the time, at this critical moment in history, to debate and decide the future of our country. Now is the time to get Scotland on the right path, the path chosen by those who live here. Now is the time for independence.
For long-time pro-independence campaigners, the news was warmly greeted.
I think many people in Scotland are going to be very pleased. I mean, we have to put up with a Boris Johnson government. Many things, of course, are devolved to the Scottish government, but many are not. And therefore, we still have inflicted on us a government we never voted for, a Conservative government. We don't vote Conservative, we get Conservative governments. And Boris Johnson is regarded as being a complete Etonian liability by people in Scotland. We want to escape.
Scots were promised a once-in-a-generation opportunity to vote for independence back in 2014, where the Yes movement narrowly missed out by 55.3% to 44.7%. Now, recent polls put the matter much more equally balanced, with an almost 50-50 split.
Boris Johnson will not want to go down in history as the Conservative leader who spearheaded the breakup of the Union. So Westminster will be doing all that it can to keep Scotland within the fold. But with such stark differences emerging between the devolved administration and London, well, the task of keeping the Union intact is becoming more difficult than ever.
The response from London has been a familiar one, simply saying now is not the right time for a vote. But some ministers have been less diplomatic.
They lost the referendum, and instead of then saying, OK, hands up, let's try and see if there's a better way, let's try and better the people of Scotland's experience with public services, she's just banged on the same one-trick pony.
Recent political events across the Union have presented a growing headache for the Conservatives, with unionists across the region losing ground. Aside from the legal battles ahead, the SNP also has to win the domestic argument. With a tough road ahead, the SNP says the Scottish people should have the right to determine their own future, a move London will attempt to thwart at every stage. Amina Taylor, London.
Afghan people affected by the earthquake in southeastern Afghanistan are grappling with dire situations. Hundreds of families are living in the open, out of fear that there may be further tremors.
For the sake of God, please help us survive this catastrophe. The earthquake has devastated our houses and livelihoods. We live outdoors. During the night, it rains very heavily. I'm afraid these harsh conditions will further harm my only surviving family members. In addition, we don't have enough food and cash.
In the meantime, the affected people in Paktika and Khost provinces say that the provided aid is not sufficient.
We thank the Afghan government and charities for assisting us with humanitarian aid, but they are not sufficient as thousands of our people in several districts have been affected by the deadly earthquake. There are a lot of children who are awaiting food and wounded people who are in dire need of medication. We ask them to scale up their assistance to our people, especially food, drinking water, and tents.
The Afghan health minister, in a press conference in Kabul on Monday, warned that the survivors of the earthquake are at risk of diseases, including mental problems.
This is very true that affected people are also exposed to getting sick. Some are getting mental or psychological illnesses because they have lost everything, including their loved ones. Some people, especially children, are at risk of malnourishment and other diseases. I call on the international community to help us stave off the disaster and create a safe situation for them to live on.
So far, the United Nations and several neighboring countries have rushed aid to the devastated areas. But helping thousands of victims remains a challenge for the foreign countries due to the U.S. restrictions imposed on the country following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan.
Afghanistan has been facing multiple humanitarian crises in the past decades. The recent earthquake is a reminder that the war-torn country should not be forgotten by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's new parliament has been inaugurated, and many expect the next 5 years will be turbulent. President Emmanuel Macron was reprimanded at the ballot box, losing his absolute majority. He then failed to cobble together a coalition, leaving France with a so-called hung parliament. Each different bill will now have to find its own majority to become enacted, although since 2012, French presidents have often resorted to executive decrees to pass unpopular, austerity-minded legislation. Many also speculate that if Parliament doesn't work in his favor, that Macron could call for new elections in maybe a matter of months.
He's not going to be able to do anything to make any reform because it's going to be completely blocked between the extreme right wing and the Mélenchon team, which are completely opposite. And so I believe that not much is going to happen during the next 5 years, which will give rise to, you know, more extreme positions in the future.
The far-right National Rally, led by Marine Le Pen, won a record 15% of seats. Islamophobia has already been obvious in France's judicial and presidential branches, and now it's widely present in their legislative branch.
We now have an assembly which better represents the range of public opinion. The president will stay in his assigned role of a sort of republican monarch. We'll see more debate, and that might produce more reforms.
A clear improvement is an increased number of working-class legislators, thanks to the NUPES leftist coalition, but even more so because of the national rally. Still, just 6% of parliamentarians are from the working class. Yael Braun-Pivet was elected speaker, the first woman to hold the post, and another relatively unknown politician from Macron's party. France is the second-to-last country in the European Union to have a woman head a House of Parliament. By denying Macron a majority, French Parliament is poised to play a bigger role than at any time in the 21st century. However, they face an executive branch which has repeatedly found ways to either sideline or bypass them. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Islamophobic abuse is something most Muslims living in Britain have to deal with, but many were shocked to discover just how dangerous the problem has become. After shocking statistics have been revealed which show a large number of British mosques have become regular targets of hate crime. According to survey data gathered by the Muslim Engagement and Development Group, also known as MEND, and in cooperation with Muslim Census, 42% of mosques and Islamic institutions have faced attacks in the past 3 years, and 35% experienced a religiously motivated attack at least once a year, with racial and religious aggravated offences increasing 15% since last year. In a statement, the government reaffirmed its earlier pledge to provide greater funding for mosque security.
We take a zero-tolerance approach to all forms of hate crime, and we are committed to rooting it out wherever it exists. In addition to funding for projects and organizations which promote diversity and tolerance, we're taking steps to safeguard places of worship with a grant of over £24.5 million available this year.
But a spokesperson from Muslim Census claimed that the government isn't doing enough to tackle the issue.
The Home Office publishes a report every year on the distribution of religious hate crimes, and almost half are experienced by Muslims in this country. Now we've got places of worship included as well. Almost half of the mosques experienced some form of religious attack as well. And it is a cause for concern. It is super alarming. And as a Muslim, you think, when will I experience something similar?
The most common form of attack is vandalism, followed by theft. However, many Islamic institutions have expressed deep fear that future attackers may resort to targeting innocent people as opposed to just property, as was the case outside Finsbury Park Mosque during a deadly terrorist attack targeting the establishment in 2017. Robert Carter, London.
At the conclusion of an official visit to Syria, an Iranian media delegation headed by Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting chief Peyman Jibili met with Syria's Minister of Culture. Jibili congratulated Syria for its victory on terror, asserting terrorism failed to destroy Syria's thousands of years old culture and civilization. He expressed readiness to launch joint projects with Syria in the media and cinema fields.
We discussed topics of mutual interest, such as producing joint movies and cultural documentaries. We also agreed to support joint cultural activities in both countries, like festivals. We hope such visits constitute a starting point for cultural exchange between the two brotherly peoples, because the will of leaderships of both states is to reach the highest level of cooperation.
Syrian Minister of Culture Lubana Mshawah said the war on Syria was aimed at extinguishing its national will and identity, but failed. She expressed Syria's willingness to set up work mechanisms for activating an exchange of expertise between both countries, as well as promoting Syria's culture in Iran and vice versa.
We discussed all details of our cultural cooperation, which would increase to match the level of our political relations. We want the two countries' people to know each other better, and culture is the perfect gateway for that. We ask Iran to play a role in training Syrian cadres in the cinema industry, and we hope to see soon Iranian artists performing at Al-Asad House for art and culture.
The delegation wrapped up the two-day visit, which included meetings with Syria's Prime Minister and Minister of Information. Stress was laid basically on increasing collaboration and joint action to create a stronger frontline against media campaigns that want to mislead the public opinion on the truth of events in the region. Discussions focused on building up stronger relations in various sectors. Officials agreed to step up cooperation between Syrian and Iranian media outlets in an effort to counter Western propaganda against countries that support resistance. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported, that the World Food Programme will suspend its activities in Yemen, will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war in Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the current truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Trades Union Congress TUC has said ministers are in talks with 13 countries with poor track record on employment rights. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington. The piece is titled TUC Issues Workers' Rights Warning Over Post-Brexit Trade Deals. In Britain, ministers have been accused of pushing post-Brexit trade deals with more than a dozen countries around the world that do not guarantee workers' rights or systematically violate employee protections. The Trades Union Congress TUC said ministers were in active talks with 13 countries with a worrying track record on employment rights, including countries like Brazil, Burundi, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, in order to secure trade deals after leaving the European Union. It comes as tensions mount between unions and the British government amid strike action over pay and conditions, with Boris Johnson's administration accused of deploying culture war tactics to drive a wedge between unionised staff and the rest of society. Ministers have promised law changes to help reduce strike disruption by allowing employers to hire agency workers to cover staff. Union leaders said the government was showing total disregard for workers around the world. According to a report from the International Trade Union Confederation, ITUC, the union's global umbrella group, sackings at P&O Ferries, where 800 workers were fired with no notice and no consultation, was one of the clearest examples of labour abuses around the world. The Trades Union Congress, TUC, said that a government that readily agrees deals with countries that abuse rights abroad is one that won't stick up for rights at home either. It called on ministers to stop attacking fundamental trade union rights and to make good on its promises to improve workplace protections. The government had promised 18 months ago that union representatives would have a place on powerful post-Brexit trade advisory groups, panels set up to be consulted on the text of trade negotiations, but had so far failed to confirm any appointments. Currently, only businesses have seats on the group. The Trades Union Congress, TUC, said the continued failure to properly consult unions in trade talks was leaving workers around the world worse off, with ministers agreeing deals lacking any enforceable labour standards. Out of the 67 non-European Union countries the British government has negotiated trade deals with, as many as five are listed in the 10 worst countries in the world for workers, according to an index published by the ITUC. And these include Colombia and Egypt. As many as 10 countries are placed in the 44 countries with no guarantee of workers' rights, including countries like Ecuador and Jordan, while 8 countries are among the 38 nations where there is systematic violation of workers' rights, including countries such as Australia and Vietnam. Last week, the government kicked off talks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to agree deals with countries covering £33.1 billion of trade across the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the PGCC, made up of nations including Bahrain, Kuwait and Qatar. However, the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said talks with these countries should be suspended because of their record unemployment rates, saying no push ahead would risk giving countries a free pass on abhorrent labour rights in a rush to agree post-Brexit deals. Paul Novak, the Deputy General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said ministers are in talks with a dozen countries which are some of the worst offenders when it comes to workers' rights. This will fuel a race to the bottom of rights. A government that readily agrees deals with countries that abuse rights abroad is one that won't stick up for rights at home either. Instead of treating trade agreements as publicity tools, the British government should be using its leverage on the global stage to ensure respect for fundamental workers' rights. A Department for International Trade spokesperson said, "We maintain a high level of protection for our labour standards and will not compromise them in any of our trade agreements. As well as meeting our obligations under the International Labour Organization, ILO, we continue to advocate for the highest labour standards and working conditions globally, including working towards eradicating modern slavery in global supply chains."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. So welcome, and today we have a new story. A miser has buried his gold in a secret place in his garden. Every day he went to this spot, dug up the treasure and counted it piece by piece to make sure it was all there. He made so many trips that a thief, who had been observing him, guessed what it was the miser had hidden, and one night quietly dug up the treasure and made off with it. When the miser discovered his loss, he was overcome with grief and despair. He groaned and cried and tore his hair. He passerby heard his cries and asked what had happened. My gold, cried the miser wildly. Someone has robbed me. Your gold? There in that hole? Why did you put it there? Why did you not keep it in the house where you could easily get it when you had to buy things? Why? Screamed the miser angrily. Why, I never touched the gold. I couldn't think of spending any of it. The stranger picked up a large stone and threw it into the hole. If that is the case, he said, cover up that stone. It is worth just as much to you as the treasure you lost. A possession is worth no more than the use we made of it. And now the continuation of Lantern. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the views of the Islamic religion regarding accumulating wealth. It must be indicated that, wealth and money and properties are very much needed for ordinary lives. However, in the Islamic religion, we find that accumulating wealth, especially gathered in a wrong way and through oppressing others or through denying other people their own rights, will not be, this kind of act, accumulating wealth by means of imposing all sorts of hardships on others, isn't an act endorsed in the Islamic religion. We find that in the Holy Quran, there are certain verses in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala promises those people who accumulate wealth, and in the Holy Quran it's indicated as, gold and silver. By gold and silver in the Holy Quran, it doesn't mean, simply gold and silver. It means, various kinds of properties, okay? However, in the Holy Quran we find that when those people who accumulate wealth but never distribute those wealth accumulated in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and they never support the needy people, they've been promised to receive very, very harsh punishments. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't want in any human community, wealth to be accumulated in certain places with the rest of people starving and being unable to satisfy their basic needs. We are all human beings, so we have to live in such a situation that, those people who don't have the right properties shouldn't feel any kind of inferiority complex when they compare themselves with the rich and with the elites of the community. Please note carefully that in the Islamic religion, the elites are not those people who are rich, financially rich. Rather, the elites are those people who are intellectually higher than others, and they are mainly the people of knowledge, people of scholarship, and so on. In the Islamic religion, there are those people who accumulate wealth, in the words of the Holy Quran, gold and silver, but translated into the economic vernacular and language of the day, those people who accumulate wealth, whether money or other things, other properties, and seldom distribute them among the needy and help the needy, they are, in fact, those people who are tyrants regarding the rights of other people. A tyrant isn't someone who punishes people without their having committed anything wrong. Rather, those people who come to deny people of their own rights, financial rights, or who deny other people of the basic needs, they are also tyrants.
lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
A financial tyrant isn't someone who is, for example, a top-ranking ruler. Even a merchant who isn't concerned with the needs of other people, who barely supports other people, the needy, especially the needy in his own community. This merchant turns into a kind of tyrant. From this perspective, we find that, in the Islamic religion, accumulating wealth isn't good in its own terms, unless accumulating wealth means that someone collects money in order to administer them, in order to manage the money, and in order to help others by means of the money he or she has collected. And, well, we know that some other people, there are many people who have collected money and properties in a right way, from a religious perspective. They've been financially active or intellectually very bright-minded, such that they've been able to help others. In the Holy Quran, as indicated in the Holy Quran, collecting gold and silver is abominable. The Holy Quran frowns upon collecting gold and silver. Now, when one of the companions of the sixth infallible Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam went to him and wanted an explication of this Quranic verse, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam explained it that by gold it isn't meant. This gold. As a metal, as a very precious metal. This gold signifies something that annihilates one's religion. And by silver, it's meant something that comes to be the fountainhead of disbelief and not believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we find that, through collecting wealth and not distributing that wealth among the needy, two abominable side effects emerge. One of them is, annihilation or disappearance of one's religion. And another one is that someone becomes, the accumulator of that wealth and becomes a disbeliever in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then, and as someone may not believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and in the judgment day, he or she will become a tyrant. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up...